Nuclear icon. Dr. Helen Caldicott has probably done more to make the public around the world aware of the dangers of nuclear weapons, nuclear war, nuclear reactors, and the entire nuclear fuel chain than any other individual in history. During her more than 60 years of activism, she has founded organizations, led protests, spoken to presidents, been a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and the focus of an Academy Award-winning film. This as she influenced several generations of activists to stand up against these weapons of mass destruction. So when the current nuclear regimes try to use the war in Ukraine to fob off the possibility of a limited, put that in quotes, nuclear war, using so-called small tactical or strategic weapons, and she tells you,
and they say, oh, it's only a small tactical nuclear weapon. A tactical nuclear weapon is dropped from an aeroplane. A strategic nuclear weapon is placed on a missile and travels thousands of miles from one country to another. The tactical nuclear weapons are supposed to be small. The Hiroshima bomb was about 13,000 tons of TNT equivalent. But the tactical weapons they have now are much bigger, like 3, 4, or 5 times bigger. If he used one of those in the Ukraine, he would incinerate and vaporize hundreds of thousands of people. It would just decimate the whole of the Ukraine.
Well, so much for the so-called advantages of a so-called limited nuclear war. When Dr. Helen Caldicott reveals to us the terrifying truth about the dangers we face from nuclear weapons, nuclear war, nuclear reactors, and the entire nuclear fuel chain, in no-nonsense medical terms, backed by an encyclopedic knowledge of the politics involved, there's no sane way for anyone to avoid understanding the magnitude of that deadly radioactive seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a very special extended interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott, an icon of our movement, and still a top international expert on all things nuclear. She's focusing our attention on a film that was made of her 1982 presentation to students at the State University of New York in Plattsburgh, New York. At the time, she was president of Physicians for Social Responsibility in the United States, and her message is clear. Disarmament cannot be postponed. It's a compelling, emotionally charged presentation based largely on what the medical impacts of nuclear war would be. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, and as always, more honest nuclear information than we'll ever be able to get on Twitter ever again. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out in Ukraine, where a landmine explosion on October 30th cut the main off-site power connection to Unit 4 at Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the latest incident underlining the fragile nuclear safety and security situation at the facility during the current military conflict. The International Atomic Energy Agency team said that there had been shelling in the vicinity of the plant in recent days, and that shelling disconnected one of Zaporizhzhia's 3 backup power lines, through which the town of Enerhodar has been receiving electricity. The power line was reconnected later that same day. In a related story, The United States has accelerated the placement of a more accurate version, that's their term, of its mainstay nuclear bombs to NATO bases in Europe. The arrival of the upgraded B-61-12 air-dropped gravity bomb, originally slated for next spring, is now planned for this December, U.S. officials told NATO allies during a closed-door meeting in Brussels in late October. The move, which involves replacing older weapons with the newer version at various storage facilities in Europe for potential use by the United States and Allied bombers and fighter jets, comes amid heightened tensions over Russia's threats to use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine, though Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Patrick Ryder said that, quote, "It is in no way linked to current events in Ukraine and was not sped up in any way." Yeah, right. In our ongoing report from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on problems with U.S. nukes, courtesy Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, last week the Shearson-Harris nuclear facility in North Carolina automatically scrammed, meaning hit the brakes from 16% power during startup to zero, after workers caused a loss of power to two coolant pumps. Also, a few days earlier, some auxiliary feed pumps at the plant were found to be inoperable. And an NRC investigation into a scram in May of 2022 at Unit 2 at Peach Bottom in Pennsylvania, it was found to be caused by operators who used the wrong procedure and mistakenly cut off power to the reactor protection systems. Operator error also called the main steam isolation valves to close, requiring actuation of the emergency core cooling system. To quote Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists on this, yikes. In Japan, long-lived radionuclides from the Fukushima nuclear power plant has had consequences for Pacific ecosystems and seafood consumers. This comes as a result of a report by Nicholas Fisher, who is a distinguished professor at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, Stony Brook University, New York. In particular, he found that bluefin tuna that spawn near Japan and migrate to waters off California were contaminated with Fukushima-derived radio cesium that they obtained from Japanese waters. We will link to his full report. In France, President Emmanuel Macron has been dealt a crushing blow after the French-owned energy company EDF warned that it was expecting a hit of approximately 28 billion euros to its full-year core earnings. The company is apparently facing a perfect storm as a result of lower-than-expected levels of nuclear production, a bigger loss than previously estimated, and its sixth profit warning this year. Last month in the UK, Boris Johnson, in one of his final acts as Prime Minister, announced plans to invest £700 million into EDF's Sizewell C project, which proposes the construction of two EPR reactors in Suffolk, England. But opposition to it is growing. The chair of the UK and Ireland nuclear-free local authorities has written to the chief executives of nine major investment firms, urging them not to invest in the nightmare of the proposed Sizewell C nuclear power station and to instead back green energy. The targeted companies are amongst the biggest investors in UK infrastructure projects, and it is inevitable that they will be approached to invest by the government and by Barclays Bank, who have been appointed by ministers to secure private backers for Sizewell C. In his letter, Councillor David Blackburn identifies the financial pitfalls of any private business investing in the uncertainties of Sizewell C, saying, "Recent experience has shown that nuclear projects are invariably delivered very late, at a cost way over their initial budgets, and can be accompanied by lengthy legal and regulatory disputes between contracting parties and with government agencies. They are bitterly opposed at every stage by local campaigners. Indeed, many such projects have ultimately failed to come to fruition, leaving corporate investors with a huge financial headache. In short, to invest in nuclear is financial madness." In Scotland, a public health warning has been issued after harmful radioactive particles were discovered to have leaked out in the area surrounding the Dounreay nuclear plant. The nuclear material detected at the shoreline near the power plant and nuclear testing facility is said to be at the highest levels in almost three decades, with 73% of the particles found deemed significant, according to the report. In Finland, cracks have now been identified in all four of the feed water pumps of the Olkiluoto 3 nuclear reactor in Finland. Root cause of the cracks and the impact this will have on the schedule for the plant's commissioning remain unknown. And finally, from Australia, news that the city of Sydney now runs on 100% wind and solar power. Who's smart enough to be next? Here is this week's special extended interview. We all come into our awareness of nuclear dangers from somewhere or someone. And for me, as for so many of you listening, that awareness came from Dr. Helen Caldicott. Wikipedia lists her as, quote, Dr. Helen Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, but she is so much more. For more than 60 years, she has led the world in awareness, organizing, confronting political power at the highest levels, and teaching us to fight back against the nuclear menace. Using medical information on the consequences to human life, she vividly explains the impact from uranium mining's devastation of mostly indigenous people to what physically happens to the human body in the wake of a nuclear bomb. Nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel winner Linus Pauling, whether you're aware of it or not, Dr. Caldicott is probably the root source for much of the anti-nuclear work that's being done today, including, if you're involved, you. Now she is reaching out from her home in Australia to reacquaint us with the Academy Award-winning 1982 film based upon her work, If You Love This Planet. This is a film that has been virtually unseen in America for shocking reasons, which you will learn about at the end of the interview. Dr. Caldicott is always informative, fascinating, knowledgeable, and ferocious in her opposition to all things nuclear. There's never enough time to capture all that she is, has done, and is still doing, but that doesn't mean I don't try. I spoke with Dr. Helen Caldicott most recently on Thursday, October 27, 2022. Dr. Helen Caldicott, it is always an honor to have you here and speak with you for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, Libby.
Remind listeners of your background as a medical professional.
Yes, well, I did medicine, started at the age 17, graduated at 22. I read a book when I was an adolescent called On the Beach by Neville Shute, and it was placed in Melbourne, and it was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident in the Northern Hemisphere, which could happen today. And it was based in Melbourne, so gradually the radioactive cloud came down to Melbourne and patients were given cyanide tablets to give to their babies so they didn't die of acute radiation illness. Men had their last gin and tonic in the Melbourne club, and eventually the streets of Melbourne were devastated. Nobody was alive. And that was the end of the human race. And that marked my psyche. I was an adolescent, and from then on, I could never experience the beautiful smells of orange blossom or smell the roses without knowing that the world could be ended, and nothing has changed.
I've heard you say that you practice global preventive medicine. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I took the Hippocratic Oath, which is sacred to me. But when I found out, first of all, I found out that the French were testing nuclear weapons in the Pacific Ocean, and the rainwater and the water, drinking water in Adelaide, where I lived, had fallout in it. So I wrote a letter to the paper, and that night I was on television teaching people about what happens if children drink milk which is contaminated with strontium-90, how they could get leukemia or cancer years later. And people were furious with the French. And every time the French blew up another bomb, I was on television. So I educated the population. Huge marches arose in the city streets spontaneously. whole pages of letters to the editor. And eventually I went to Paris with the upcoming deputy prime minister to see the French government. And they said, well, our bombs are perfectly safe. So Jim Cairns, the deputy prime minister, said, well, why don't you blow them up in the Mediterranean? And they turned bright white and said, mon Dieu, there are too many people living around the Mediterranean. So for the first time in my life, I realized I was sitting opposite wicked politicians who didn't give one good damn if children died of leukemia. And then such was the pressure politically that the prime minister took France to the International Court of Justice, and the ruling ruled against them, and that she was forced to test on the ground. So that was my first experience at practice in global preventive medicine per se. Then I found out Australia wanted to mine uranium. So I went to see the prime minister, who didn't want to talk to me. I got a book out of the library called Poisoned Power by John Goffman. And I read that and I was just, I couldn't believe it was so dangerous. And so I didn't know what to do this time, but I knew a man who was an engine driver in the unions. And at that stage, our whole workforce in Australia was unionized. And he said, look, let's write a letter to all the unions in Australia asking if you can talk to them. So I did. And I traveled around up to Northern Territory, to Darwin, to talk to men at 6 a.m. before they went out on their work schedules, drawing sperm and testicles and genes on dirty old blackboards, educating them. I traveled all around Australia educating the unions. I spoke to some hoary old men in the National Railways Union. I thought I'd had no impact, but the next day they called a national strike on uranium mining and nobody could get to work. And eventually the Australian Council of Trade Unions passed a resolution that they would neither mine, transport, nor export uranium. So that was, again, practicing global preventive medicine by educating people. And it's what doctors should do anyway, about their use of antibiotics and how we should live and behave, etc. So those were my two initiating experiences.
And of course, you have spent how many decades is it now doing this kind of global preventive medicine, otherwise known as educating us about the dangers and the consequences of nuclear?
Well, I'm 84 now, so it must be about 60 years.
And of course, you went on to have an extensive medical practice in the United States.
Yes, I traveled to Harvard with my husband. I had 3 little children, under 3 actually at the time. But because I was bored, I got a part-time job at Harvard Children's Hospital Medical Center in the cystic fibrosis clinic. And there I learned to treat cystic fibrosis. Then I came back to Australia and I wasn't a qualified pediatrician. So I went to the hospital to become a resident medical officer for a year, working 80 hours a week to get my degree. To become a physician. And I then set up the first CF clinic in Adelaide, which in Australia, which now has the best longevity results in Australia. And at the time I was doing the French test issue. So I would rush up to my bedroom, take off my white coat, do an interview, rush back and treat the patients. And that was a pretty intense time.
Let's switch this to the current time, because you clearly have credentials stretching back decades. Now, the major nuclear discussion going on in the world centers around Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There are people who think that Putin will use nuclear weapons. He's certainly threatening to. And then there are people who think, no, there's no way that he will. But what if he does? What would the impact and the consequence be, and what could we expect the United States' response to be if that unthinkable thing does happen?
Well, first of all, and they say, oh, it's only a small tactical nuclear weapon. A tactical nuclear weapon is dropped from an aeroplane. A strategic nuclear weapon is placed on a missile and travels thousands of miles from one country to another. The tactical nuclear weapons are supposed to be small. The Hiroshima bomb was about 13,000 tons of TNT equivalent. But the tactical weapons they have now are much bigger. like 3, 4, or 5 times bigger. If he used one of those in the Ukraine, he would incinerate and vaporize hundreds of thousands of people. It would just decimate the whole of the Ukraine. There would be intense fires everywhere. And the way the world is postured now, America may respond with nuclear weapons or may not. I don't know what the thinking is, but America's got satellites in the air and they watch all the time to see if missiles are coming from Russia. And if it's detected that there are missiles coming from Russia, the president has 3 minutes to decide whether or not to press the button and launch America's missiles, which are located in the Midwest. So things are very tenuous. Mistakes have been made during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was only because there was a very brave man on a Russian nuclear submarine who got an order to launch, who did not. I got to know Robert McNamara, who was then JFK Secretary of Defense, and he said, "Helen, we came so close to within 3 minutes." So things are very, very tenuous and delicate in this nuclear aberration that we have on the planet. And it's quite possible that America would respond and then we'll have a nuclear holocaust and we'll all eventually die.
You recently had an interview posted where you went into great and pretty stomach-churning detail about exactly what would happen with the landing of a nuclear weapon. Could you run down some of the medical effects should nuclear war ensue, and should there be even a single nuclear weapon, a tactical or strategic weapon that lands somewhere?
Well, if it's a global nuclear war, hundreds of millions of people would die because every town and city in America with a population, it may have changed, but with a population of 50,000 people or more is targeted with a nuclear weapon. There's such a redundancy of weapons that everything's targeted. I mean, I don't know if it's the same, but in the past, the bridges, all the bridges in New York were targeted. The airports were targeted. I mean, it was just absolutely ridiculous. And what happens is when the bombs land and explode with a heat which is 20 times more intense than the heat inside the center of the sun, there's a blinding flash. If you look at the flash, you'll be instantly blinded. But anyway, you'll probably be incinerated. In Hiroshima, a little boy was reaching up to catch a red dragonfly in his hand against the blue sky. There was a blinding flash and he disappeared, leaving his shadow on the concrete behind him. That's what happens to people. If people are in fallout shelters, they'll probably die because, as in Dresden, the firestorms will be so intense, all the oxygen will be sucked out of the shelters and they'll die of asphyxiation. In the cities and towns, which are all targeted, everyone will die from the heat and the fire. And the firestorms will be so intense that they will spread across America from the east coast to the west coast, north to south, and most of America will burn. When the Pentagon worked out the effects of nuclear war, they never ever included firestorms. They only included blasts. A book was written by Lynn Eden talking about fire, and that was absolutely not included in their thinking. If you're in a fallout shelter, you can't come out for months because the fallout will be so intense that you would develop acute radiation illness. And that involves the killing off of your blood cells and the gut cells. So you don't have any platelets, so you'll bleed to death and you'll have vomiting and diarrhea. It's a horrible death. And that's the first time it was ever seen in Hiroshima. America let no journalists into Hiroshima, none. But one man got in called Wilfred Burchett, who was an Australian, and he was the first to describe the hospitals full of these dying patients who had acute radiation illness. They say that if you're in a fallout shelter, this is Federal Emergency Management Agency, only old people should go out and collect food. Well, the food will be radioactive anyway, but, you know, it doesn't matter if they die. The young people should be protected. I mean, the whole thing is absolutely ridiculous. The Federal Emergency Management Agency in the days gone by said that if there's going to be a nuclear war, all the odd-numbered plates on the cars should leave and drive to a distant town in the country, and then the next day all the even-numbered plates on the cars will drive to a distant place. And leave enough food to feed your pets, don't take any drugs, and if there is a nuclear war, you park your car by the side of the road, you get out a shovel and dig a hole 3 feet by 6 feet and get in the hole, and someone has to put 2 doors on top and dirt on top of that. And there was a man called T.K. Jones in the Federal Emergency Management Agency who said it's the dirt that does it. And I was invited to a huge meeting in Hollywood with all the film stars to address this fact, because the Playboy man, Playboy magazine.
Oh, Hugh Hefner.
Yeah, he was going to excerpt the book called With Enough Shovels, and he did in his magazine. And I was introduced by Paul Newman, who kissed my hand. It was so lovely. But all the film stars were there, and I gave this impassioned address and said, now go out and look at the stars and realize where the only life in the universe. And then a tall girl came up and said, I think you're the only person on earth who can change my father's mind. And it was Patty Davis.
That's Patty Davis, who is President Reagan's daughter.
Yes. Will you meet with him? And I said, yes, but only alone, not with Meese Baker or Diva. So I had an hour and a quarter with Reagan in the White House, in the downstairs library, in which there were no books. Patty said silently, and I'm the only person to have spent that length of time alone with Reagan. He didn't know anything. He was quoting to me from the Reader's Digest. All his facts were wrong. I'd just written my book, Missile Envy, and I had facts and figures pouring out of me. So I had to correct him. And when I did, he'd get what we call a malar flush. His cheeks would flush because he'd get anxious. So half the time I held his hand to reassure him and establish doctor-patient relationship with him. I don't know if I did any good, but, you know, because there was such a huge movement in the 80s where we physicians and others taught the American people the medical effects of nuclear war, he then met with Gorbachev in Reykjavik in 1988. And over a mere weekend, those two men almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons, but they got stuck up on Star Wars. Gorbachev knew it would never work. Reagan was committed to it, and so they ended the meeting without abolishing nuclear weapons. What a history. And that was the end of the Cold War after they met.
And, of course, we have not only revived the Cold War, but it's threatening to get hotter every day because of the situation in Ukraine and the threats going back and forth from Russia at Ukraine, but the United States weighing in, and the two leaders at this point not speaking to each other, but being at complete loggerheads and holding the future of the world between them.
Yes.
And we have no say in it.
Well, we should have a say. I mean, I'd like to go and see Biden and say, for Christ's sake, Biden, what do you think you're doing? Give in to the man. Give him what he wants. You know, don't let the Ukraine join NATO. Remove all the missiles you've placed in the newly arisen NATO countries, which were liberated at the end of the Cold War. They've got missiles all along the border of Russia, focusing into Russia. And he said, please get rid of those missiles and don't let the Ukraine join NATO. And go and talk to the man. Don't press his back against the wall. You know, it's medically contraindicated to threaten a paranoid patient. And I'm sure he's paranoid now. And he's got a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons, like 5,000, which would decimate the world. Go and see the man, say, for Christ, what are we doing? You know, let's stop this dreadful killing in the Ukraine of civilians and let's negotiate, end this. And now let's abolish nuclear weapons, because before the United Nations, there's a treaty now to abolish nuclear weapons. Many countries have signed them, but guess which ones haven't? All the nuclear countries. And, you know, I just think it's a case of testosterone poisoning, Libby. These weapons represent a huge sort of, well, as the Pentagon describes it in public meetings in front of women, we'll have a nuclear explosion like one big orgasmic wump. So there's a psychology behind all of this. And where are the women? Nowhere. 52% of us are women. And we have hormones called oxytocin, which is a nurturing, beautiful hormone that's liberated when we breastfeed our babies or at times of tension and stress. And yet we sit back. So, you know, we are in a very vulnerable situation. I'm not sure if we're going to make it. In fact, every day I wake up and look at my roses and think, well, they're still here.
I have a stream that I go to several times a week just to be able to sit in nature, look at things and go, okay, this still works. This part of life is still nurturing life. And the first thing I do in the morning is check the news to see if anything has been launched, or in the case of Ukraine, and this brings up another aspect of the nuclear danger, whether there has been any further compromise to the sixth nuclear reactor facility at Zaporizhia.
Right. Well, that's another kind of nuclear war. You know, over a million people in Europe have died since Chernobyl. Parts of Europe are very radioactive. I don't buy European food because I don't know what's got radiation in it and what hasn't. But these reactors are larger than Chernobyl, and they've got their cooling pools beside them with spent or radioactive fuel rods that have been taken out of the reactor at the end of their time. And there's a huge amount of radioactivity at those reactors. I mean, if one of them goes, that will just totally devastate Europe. So there are two kinds of nuclear war. There's nuclear weapons or there are meltdowns at reactors. Now, if the Second World War was fought today, Europe would be uninhabitable because all the reactors would melt down and that would be the end of Europe. Would be so radioactive, everyone would die.
There's something I'd like you to weigh in on, and this is both nuclear and personal, because I have had one or two angry listeners contact me and say that really Ukraine is bombing itself at Zaporizhia, and that the current risk at the Kakhovka hydroelectric dam, which feeds the reservoir that Zaporizhia pulls from for its cooling, and also is upstream of at least 80 separate Ukrainian villages or cities, that Ukraine is doing it to themselves for some obscure, twisted political reasons. And these claims make no sense to me. There's no reason I can see that Ukraine would gain by either bombing itself or sending missiles on itself or bombing its own dam to flood itself and deprive the nuclear reactors of cooling water. And I just like you to weigh in on these accusations, which very few people, but very vocal people, have been coming at me with.
Oh, I think they're paranoid. I don't believe that. Not that I have any data to confirm nor deny it. So I have no idea, but the only absolutely stupid people would do that, destroy the electricity system which supplies those reactors. A reactor needs 1 million gallons of water a minute to cool it. If the pumps go off because there's no electricity to power them, then there'll be a meltdown. That's what happened at Fukushima, actually, because they lost their power and the reactors all melted down. I can't believe that, I can imagine Russia doing that, but I can't believe the Ukraine would be doing that to destroy itself. That's committing suicide, nuclear suicide.
We'll return to this week's special extended interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott in just a moment. But first, nuclear weapons, manufacturing, reactors, uranium mining, radioactive waste, accidents, so-called permissible radiation exposures. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters is as endless as plutonium, which remains deadly radioactive for 240,000 years. Yet despite the known risks to people and the environment, the nuclear industry perpetuates itself, making obscene amounts of money and undermining the implementation of genuine renewables while threatening the future of the planet and of life itself. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to help you know and understand what's going on in the nuclear world and what you can do about it. We cover not only what the industry is up to, but how brave activists around the world are fighting back, and how any one of us, yes, even you, can take action to try to stop this nuclear madness. Now in its 12th year, Nuclear Hot Seat is the only podcast where you can reliably get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week, including interviews with genuine experts and frontline activists, international news, numbnuts of the week, and the hot story. We bring you the stories and insights that the nukesters and their political minions would rather you not know. But in order to continue to do our work, we need your help. I'll be honest, current economics have dangerously cut into our donations, and what's coming in does not cover the amount that's going out every month. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation, any amount you can, to support the work that brings you this kind of interview with Dr. Caldicott. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red donate button there to click on, and follow the prompts to send us $5, $500, or a monthly recurring donation of any amount. So if you value Nuclear Hot Seat and want to help us continue this work, please do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's the continuation of this week's extended feature interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott. And that brings me to another question, and this is more existential. How could we as a species let this happen? Do we have some kind of species-wide recessive suicide gene that has somehow found a way to express itself? And that's why we have this nuclear insanity and cannot seem to do anything to stop it, slow it, or get rid of it?
I think that we're an evolutionary aberrant. I once asked Carl Sagan, did he think there'd be any other life in the universe? And he paused for a long time, and then he said no. And I said, why? And he said, because if any species had reached our stage of evolution, they would have destroyed themselves, which was very profound. We're highly intelligent, emotionally not so intelligent. I mean, when you look at the Greek vases, there are men on horses killing each other way back. All the way back. And it just seems that men have to go to war to prove themselves or prove their masculinity, or I call it testosterone poisoning. And we sit back, you know, and shine their boots and make them feel good about themselves as they destroy each other. The First World War was absolutely hideously ghastly, and the men who come back from war never recover. Because I've been killing people. I mean, what that does to your psyche. I think we're intellectually intelligent and emotionally deprived. And because the women understand but don't have the guts to stand up, I mean, Lysistrata was a Greek play where the men kept fighting and killing each other. And the women said, okay, no sex until you stop it. Well, they stopped it. There's a country in Africa, and I can't remember which one, where the president or prime minister was a woman, and she did the same thing, and the men stopped killing. Isn't it interesting that sex is so profound for men that if they're deprived of it, they'll stop whatever they're doing?
It's certainly a strategy that we can try, because there don't seem to be many others that have worked, certainly nothing that has worked yet.
Well, I mean, the Pentagon's so powerful now. The military-industrial complex runs America. almost all of the Congress people and senators are corporate prostitutes. They are paid hundreds of millions of dollars consistently by the military-industrial complex. So they don't represent us at all. They represent the killers. I call the Department of Defense now the Department of Murder because that's what they do. They build weapons to murder people. And they've been murdering people. I mean, I think they've killed, I can't remember, since 9/11, millions of people. I can't remember how many. You know, if you murder someone, you go to jail. But if you murder people in a war, you get medals.
There's also an interview that was recently posted where you spoke about the reason why certain Congress people will never vote against nuclear weapons. And there's a certain sense of their own privilege and entitlement that goes along with it. Would you speak to that point?
Yes, that's interesting. The military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, all of them, Boeing, have been very clever. They've put factories making parts of weapons in every congressional district, like a seat for an F-35 in one district, the landing wheels in another, et cetera, all across the country. So if a resolution comes up before Congress to stop building nuclear weapons, et cetera, they vote against it because it's jobs in the district. And even Bernie Sanders is culpable of that.
On last week's Nuclear Hot Seat, we featured a 2018 interview I conducted with Rachel Bronson of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and she talked extensively about the doomsday clock, which is the representation of scientists' projection of how close to planetary annihilation humanity is. That clock was most recently set in January of this year, just repeating the setting of the previous 2 years at 100 seconds to midnight. And that was before Russia's invasion of Ukraine and all that has followed. Yet, even though the bulletin has been contacted by many, many people, activists, scientists, etc., and at least one podcaster I can think of, they have resisted resetting the clock until January. If you were to set that doomsday clock today, where would you put it?
5 seconds.
Wow. Do you think we'll get to January to be able to watch them reset it?
It's in the hands of the gods, Libby. And I don't believe in God. I have no idea. But my intuition says that we're extremely close. And, you know, the system is so complex in controlling nuclear weapons, launching them. How many people can launch? I mean, in the missile silos, there are two young men, each armed with the pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. They take drugs before they go down there. They go to sleep. They operate with floppy disks. They have a huge missile with a huge hydrogen bomb on it. There are so many ways that accidents can occur, particularly at a time of heightened international tension, that we'll be lucky to make it. Everyone's worried about global warming, which is absolutely dire, but so maybe we'll have a nuclear war, a nuclear winter, and that'll counteract global warming. I'm being facetious.
Unfortunately, there are some people who cite that as a possibility, and they're not being facetious. So the mental illness connected with nuclear seems to run very deep. That's what I label it. It's a mental illness. It's an insanity that someone
it's
can
psychosis.
Look
at. It's psychosis.
One of the reasons that we are talking today is that you were the subject of a 1982 documentary entitled If You Love This Planet, which went on to win the 1982 Academy Award for Best Short Documentary. It's now being made available again on YouTube. I know you have a link on your website, and we will have a link to it up on the Nuclear Hot Seat website as well. Tell us about what this film is and what it does.
Well, I had to go to Plattsburgh, New York to give a talk. I think it was the second talk that day, and I was absolutely exhausted. When I arrived, there were all these sort of Klieg lights all over the auditorium, and I thought, oh, my God, I can't do it. Anyway, I gave the talk, and it was just near an Air Force base, and there were B-52s flying overhead, I'm sure, with their nuclear weapons on board as I talked. So I gave this talk, and it was my typical medical talk about the effects of nuclear war. And I didn't like the film when I first saw it, but they turned it into this film with lots of shots of Hiroshima and the like. And it's actually, as I look at it now, quite profound. The audience reaction is profound. And what it does is it breaks through people's psychic numbing, gets them in the gut. It's like when I have to tell a patient they have cancer or their child has cancer. You have to help them through this dreadful shock, disbelief. I mean, and it's the same like the world's got cancer. And so I was really being a doctor talking to my patients, and people are crying at the end. Now, it's only half an hour long, but it makes people emotionally understand what the world is facing. And when they get it, they get first grief-stricken, and then they get angry, and then they act. And that's why I want everyone in the world, but particularly in America, to watch this film now. Get off your bottoms, away from your computers, get in the streets, but more than that, go and see your congresspeople and senators, and go and see them and say, you are not my leader. I am your leader. You are my representative. You read this book, you look at this film, and you will rise up and get your colleagues, and you will vote against the war in Ukraine. You'll help Putin get out of it, and you will start to get rid of nuclear weapons and stop voting for the bloody things, as you do all the time. Now, nothing threatens a congressperson or a senator than losing their seat. And when 80% of Americans were opposed to nuclear weapons during the nuclear freeze era, which Randy Forsberg wrote the freeze, but I was the leader of the whole movement in America, I could go to Congress and Tip O'Neill would come off from chairing the House floor, and he would come to his office and say, what can I do for you, doctor? He was such a sweetie. And that was only because he knew that 80% of Americans supported me in opposed nuclear weapons. That's the power. So this film should be played on television across the country, PBS, on all the commercial stations, to wake people up. And once they're awoken, you'll be amazed what they'll do. We saw that in the 80s, Libby.
You've been doing this work now for more than 60 years. How did you keep going? Did there ever come a time in all those years where you looked at it and what could seem to be the futility of it and say, enough, and want to walk away?
Never. No, because I'm a doctor. You know, when I've been working all day in the wards and then staying up all night with a dying patient, do I ever say, oh, look, I'm tired, bugger this, I'm going to bed? You don't do that when you're a doctor. I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor in every cell of my body. The Hippocratic Oath is sacred to me. That's it. Sorry, I was born to be a doctor. I am a doctor. I love being a doctor. I love practicing medicine. I miss my patients so much.
And what is it that you do to nourish yourself along the way and keep yourself going?
Well, I've got three gorgeous kids who are now reaching nearly 60. I've got seven fantastic grandchildren. I love my garden. I go out every day and watch every leaf and petal unfold. I love cooking. I'm crazy about cooking. I've got a lot of cookery books. I've got a partner who I love. I'm generally a very happy person because I'm doing what I know I was born to do, I suppose. My two heroes as a little girl were Robin Hood and the Good Samaritan. I remember lying in bed beside my father one Sunday morning. I must have been really young, five. And I said, they hit him and they bound his head with oil and they looked after him. So, and Robin Hood was just the antithesis of good for me. So I don't know. That's who I am.
Is there anything we haven't covered during our talk that you would like to add at this time?
Know that what I've been saying is a profound truth. It's a horrible truth. It's like you've been told you've got a terminal disease. And take it in, feel the pain and grief, understand what a privilege that you were even conceived. It occurred to me one day as I was driving that of the millions of sperm my father ejaculated that night, my sperm, because they're all different, my sperm reached my egg. And what an extraordinary privilege it is that we were even conceived and born. And that privilege extends to responsibility. What a privilege to live on this planet, which, I mean, if you look at evolution, it's absolutely magical. If you look at the electron microscopy of life within a single cell, it's so magical. I look at my Facebook and look at all these magnificent birds. Magnificent. How did they evolve? So beautiful. And realize we are so privileged. We hold life on the earth in the palm of our hand. And one person like Joan of Arc can save the planet. Is that you?
I don't know, but I'm sure trying.
I know you are.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, as I said in the beginning, and I say always, it is an honor to be able to spend time and talk with you about these excruciatingly important issues and gain your wisdom, your perspective, your sense of history, your sense of destiny about it all, so we can frame it as something terribly important that each one of us needs to do if we're going to stop the nuclear lemmings from pushing us all off a cliff and destroying that which is precious and that which is sacred, which is life. So for all you have done, for all you continue to do, and for being such a spirit and a life force for us all, thank you, Dr. Helen Caldicott, for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
That's my great pleasure, Libby, and thank you for what you're doing.
Dr. Helen Caldicott. As often happens after I conclude an interview, we engaged in a bit of chit-chat, and that revealed a juicy tidbit that did not make its way into the body of our talk. That's what happened here when Dr. Caldicott provided this eye-opening, jaw-dropping piece of information about the film If You Love This Planet, and why, especially if you're in the United States, you haven't seen it.
Let me tell you that when the film came out, the U.S. Justice Department banned it as foreign propaganda. You had to register with the Justice Department to play it. So no one did in America. It was taken to the Congress. There were hearings. And the producer then made a film called If You Love Free Speech.
And it was about this particular case?
Absolutely. This one.
So that should be up as a companion film.
Well, I don't know where it is, but she made it. Yeah, it would be in the Canadian Film Board's repository, I would think.
And if that doesn't motivate you to watch If You Love This Planet, I don't know what will. The film is available on YouTube, and we will link to it from our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 593. I'm also talking with my web genius about making it a permanent feature on the landing page. Understand that if you haven't caught the film online and you're in the United States, you have been prevented for decades from seeing a film which is so powerfully opposed to nuclear that it was banned in this country. So please, watch it, share it, send the link to your friends, to your congresspeople, get it on college campuses, and then take the resulting emotions to fuel your activist response and help others to find theirs. And if you have any good connections with the Canadian Film Board, let's see if we can find the companion piece, If You Love Free Speech. And for a deeper dive, on the website, we will link to the books Dr. Caldicott mentioned during this interview, including Poisoned Power by John Goffman, Whole World on Fire by Lynn Eden, With Enough Shovels, Reagan, Bush, and Nuclear War by Robert Scheer, The Cornerstone Book by Alexei Yablokov, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Disaster for People and the Environment, and Dr. Caldicott's book, Missile Envy. As for the book she cited, The Dirt That Does It, I have not been able to find a single reference to it anywhere online. If you have a link, please send it to me at info@nuclearhotseat.com. All of the books I mentioned are linked to Amazon if you wish to purchase them, but know that they're also available through your local bookstores, and we encourage you to buy locally and purchase them there. By the way, when Dr. Caldicott spoke of the one journalist who managed to get into Hiroshima and report on the lingering ravages of radiation poisoning on the population, that's the story of Wilfred Burchett. And after 7 years of research, it's a major focus of the play that I've been working on, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It's currently in draft form, and I'm looking for a theater workshop or development program. So if you know of some place where I can continue to work on this revelatory piece of theater, send that information to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. You know, the nuclear news keeps evolving, and you've got to keep up with it to understand exactly how many moves are being made to expand and exploit this technology. And if you want to be kept in the know, you need to listen to Nuclear Hot Seat every week and not risk missing a single episode. And it's really easy for you to do. You can get the show delivered to you via email every week as soon as it posts by going to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and ta-da! Every week you will get one email, we don't bug you, just one, which includes the link and a short description of the show's content. And of course, you can also sign up on whatever your favorite podcast channel is. We are all over the place and around the world. Now, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything you can do, we always appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2022, Libby Halevy and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed as long as you cite the program, the website, and any other details you would care to put in. This is Libby Halevy, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, we are one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation. There you go. You've just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.